Okay, so what was my title? I've forgotten. Right, so the title was Two Manifolds. Two Manifolds. And Supersymmetric Gauge Theory. So this is a story about a part of mathematics which is still under development and which is being inspired by some things from physics. And the starting point in physics is a physical theory which, even by physicist standards, is not very well understood. So... pardon? So, this is a theory which arises as, I mean, it arises several places in physics, but it's a six-dimensional physical theory. And six-dimensional means five plus one. So there are five spatial dimensions and one time dimension. One of the ways that physicists have of studying this theory is to take an object called an M5 brain in M theory, and maybe we should take n, sorry, didn't leave enough room, we should take n coincident M5 brains in what's known as M theory. Okay, so if you don't know what these things are, it doesn't matter because this is kind of motivation. But M theory is a supersymmetric 11-dimensional theory, and the reason, one of the reasons the letter M was chosen is because it's a very mysterious theory. Nobody really knows how to study it. That, you know, I hope that wasn't a self-perpetuating notion. That term was chosen, you know, back in the late 90s, and it's still a mysterious theory, which is too bad. But it has objects in it known as M5 brains, so that means a 5 plus 1 dimensional object. So these brain things are labeled by the number of spatial dimensions and the time is suppressed. It also has objects known as M2 brains, which will play a role in just a moment. Those are two spatial dimension objects. And it's expected that if you put on top of each other n parallel M5 brains, you'll get some interesting physical theory which lives on those M5 brains alone. So this is a common theme in modern physical theories, that you can have physical theories which are bound to submanifolds of an entire space and which somehow interact with a physical theory in the larger space. So those are often known as the bulk degrees of freedom, the things in the larger space, and whatever the smaller space is, that you would have the localized degrees of freedom on that smaller space. So there should be some kind of physical theory on this, on these M5 brains, and it involves a physical field, a self-dual two-tensor, which doesn't have a good Lagrangian description, and that's one of the reasons why it's extremely difficult to write down to study in any detail this particular class of physical theories. So there are lots of reasons for believing that such a physical theory should exist, but because it doesn't have a good Lagrangian description, it's very hard to study, and so people know things about it indirectly. So the kind of indirect study of these physical theories, so by the way, I mean, this can be regarded from a mathematical point of view as some conjectural object which we don't know how to access directly, but we can gather evidence about what its properties ought to be by studying some pieces of it. So, you know, for example, if you're interested in the Riemann hypothesis, you can locate the first n zeros and verify that they're in the right place as you go up the upper half plane, and that's been done for very large values of n. And in fact, it's even been done for some range of even larger values of n, which leaves a gap, right? I mean, somebody figured out a computational technique to go way up and sort of see if, you know, maybe by guessing some region way up there, they could find some zeros that didn't obey the hypothesis, and they didn't. So it's a kind of indirect study in that sense. And the indirect study is to, so this was M theory on, well, it's a 10 plus 1 dimensional theory, so people usually denote the Minkowski space by M10, 1, 10 spatial and 1 time dimensions. And the indirect study is by considering the theory on spaces like MK1 cross a compact space of dimension 10 minus K. So this should be compact. Attempting to do some kind of expansion in, say, eigenvalues of the Laplace operator on this compact manifold or something of that sort, to give what's called an effective physical theory in dimension k plus 1. So you would hope to get a physical theory in dimension k plus 1 out of a construction like this, I actually wanted to start with the intrinsic theory on the brain, so I want to reduce the spatial dimension from 5. So the mysterious theory should give a theory, a physical theory in lower dimensions. And so one way to possibly approach it is to study physical theories in low dimensions, which might, if this whole picture hangs together, be coming from the higher dimensional theory. So the first case to consider is the case where your 5 minus k dimensional manifold is one dimension. If I want a compact one manifold, that means I have a circle, so it's M41 cross a circle. And in this case, the theory with n coincident M5 brains becomes, if you look at the so-called effective theory in M41, it becomes an ordinary gauge field theory. This mysterious field that I mentioned, which was a self-dual 2-tensor, the 2-tensor has a component that got integrated around the S1 to give me a one form instead of a 2 form, so self-dual 2 form. And the one form is okay. It's a familiar object. It's what's called a gauge field in physical theories. And there's this is non-abelian gauge theory, and there's an associated group, and the group, in the case of N brains, was SUN. So it's a gauge field theory with a particular gauge group, and that gauge group was related to the number of coincident M5 brains. I should say that the six-dimensional theory, so this particular one was labeled by the Dinkin diagram, or Lie algebra, Dinkin diagram AN minus 1, which corresponds to the Lie algebra little SUN, and there are other ones for the D's and the E's. So there's a whole ADE classification of these mysterious theories. For the story I'm going to tell today, mainly we'll focus on the case of SU2 and not worry about how to put together things that would involve bigger gauge groups.
Question?
Yes?
The mysterious self-dual 2 tensor is we don't know what the Lagrangian is, we know there is none.
Okay, so we have a Lagrangian for a two-form that's not symmetric, but if you pair it with a particular, if you pair the self-dual two-form with the graviton, then there is a way of writing down a Lagrangian for one guy, but that, if I remember correctly, only works in 1,0 supersymmetry. If you try to enhance it to 2,0 supersymmetry or include additional tensors, there's not a Lagrangian description. And I guess this is just one 2-tensor, but it's in 2,0 supersymmetry. Actually, yeah, I should look that up. I haven't looked at that for a while. I do know that in the case of 1,0 theories with self-dual 2-forms, the problem is that if you have a single one, there's a way of writing down the Lagrangian. It's a slightly artificial way of writing down a Lagrangian because it requires the graviton with it. But then if you have multiple ones, which there are physical theories that do, there's no way of writing it down. If you have none, there's no way of writing it down. It's a weird situation. Yes?
So I thought, like, in the case when n was 1, there was some sort of, like, a holographic type way of writing down an action. In the same sense that a chiral boson in 2 dimensions, you could define it as a partition function of Chern Simons. And so somehow I thought that there was a higher dimensional, like, topological theory using which you could write down an action.
For n equal 1?
Yeah, for the case of 1 and 5.
Maybe, but I care about more than 1.
Are these pictures part of your talk?
No, these pictures are left over from the previous talk, and it's such great fortune. I've got to make use of it, so I'm leaving it there until I can make use of it. And the speaker also took away the color chalk, so I can't annotate the formula in any way. So that's the main thing to be said. We've got this physical theory, which is a gauge field theory with gauge group SUN. A few more words for the physicists in the audience. You wrap the M5 brain on a circle and you get a D4 brain, a stack of D4 brains that has a gauge field. That's where the gauge field theory comes from. One interesting fact is that the size of the circle, the circumference of the circle, corresponds roughly to the coupling of the gauge field. The circumference just corresponds to the coupling. Some power, who knows. But the point is that a weakly coupled gauge field is going to correspond to a small circumference of the compactifying circle. Okay, next case. Next case is M3, 1 cross a surface. And I should say at the outset that although I originally said compact, I'm going to allow I'll just call it a Riemann surface because it's got a metric, and maybe the important thing is the conformal class of metrics or something like that.
So David, is the 11-dimensional stuff out of the picture from now on?
The 11-dimensional stuff is out of the picture. In a few minutes, I'll use this bulk brain idea to talk about boundaries in four-dimensional physical theories. The fact that I can put an M2 brain in the story I'm about to invoke, but basically we're working with the six-dimensional theory reduced. And after sort of 20 minutes, after I've done the setup, we're basically going to be studying four and three-dimensional physical theories as kind of analogs of which are supposed to be somehow associated to two and three manifolds, and then try to use that idea to build up interesting classes of theories which ought to be the reduction on two and three manifolds of the mysterious six-dimensional theory. That's kind of the idea. So I'll take M3-1 cross a Riemann surface, and I'm going to allow a punctured Riemann surface. So there's a slight variant of this construction in which my M5 brain can contain an M2 brain. So that's allowed in these theories and doesn't change the amount of supersymmetry or things of that sort. So I have these two different dimensions of physical theories where I can have something different happening on an M2 brain contained in the M5 brain contained in all of M theory. And now what I'm imagining doing is putting my M5 brain on sigma cross R31 and then putting the M2 brain on on a puncture, so a point of sigma cross an R21. Wow, that didn't work well. Yeah, that's not the puncture theory. So I'm very sorry. So punctures allowed is not the right comment. So I want to put this on a loop in sigma. Cross R11. Sorry, I got ahead of myself. This is something called Wilson line operators in the theory, but I should have mentioned the punctures first. So in the punctures, I'll just say the punctures are allowed. And in fact, you know, M theory is a gravity theory. We're getting some gauge fields out of this gravity theory by virtue of doing things like taking coincident brains and then looking at the solution near that. In the supergravity context, you end up getting things like gauge fields coming out of what are essentially solutions to a gravity problem. And here, when I've allowed punctures, I'm going to want to put a complete metric on the Riemann surface with punctures. So I'll be looking at a punctured Riemann surface with a finite volume complete metric There are interesting things happening physically associated to the punctures, which are a little tricky to say. In that context, I can then invoke another piece of the bigger story, which is to try to study a certain class of operators in this physical theory. So by now, if I have my Riemann surface, I have some, I'll just call it a complicated four-dimensional physical theory. This class of theories these days are often called Giotto theories. About 2.5 years ago, Davide Giotto started emphasizing these theories as interesting things to study. And one of the things that you could do in these theories is to try to study what are called Wilson line operators. So those are things that are localized on one space and one time dimension within the theory. It's called a line because it's one spatial dimension. And to get such a thing and put it on the compact in this setting, I should use a curve, a real curve, sitting inside that Riemann surface to sort of label the Wilson line operator. I do apologize. I got slightly ahead of myself in talking about that. So we get these 4D theories called Giotto theories. I'll come back to the Wilson line operators in just a minute. And let me explain how Giotto proposed to think about these theories. An appropriate metric or conformal class of metrics, so for an appropriate metric on sigma, sigma has the following sort of structure. It breaks up into long tubes which are joined together by pant diagrams. And thinking of it as a long, thin tube is really a statement about the metric. So I want the metric to have been chosen so that the circumference of the circles around those tubes, I should take some minimal length circles around the tube, the circumference of those circles are all kind of small. So this is an interesting way of describing Riemann surfaces. It also works for punctured Riemann surfaces. I can describe a punctured Riemann surface as a collection of long tubes in an appropriate region in the moduli space, as a collection of long tubes glued together by things that are topologically Pants diagrams. If you didn't quite catch that, it's this. Oops, I can do better. It's this sort of diagram, plumbing fixture, right? Glued together by Pants diagrams, where at punctures I have to allow one or more of the plumbing fixture legs to have shrunk down to zero size. So I'm not going to treat those as separate objects. That's just a plumbing fixture with a very very tiny, you know, infinitesimally tiny waist or cuff at that particular point. Okay, so for an appropriate metric, I get a picture like this. And now, if you think about the tube, so you can maybe try to think about the whole physical theory as being built from fundamental pieces. So the tube looks just like my compactification on a circle, together with some long direction. And if I'm allowed to ignore the places where it connects, then I think that all I got was a gauge theory, except it's one dimension down by now. So here I should get SUN. Well, I'm doing N equal 2, so I should get SU2 gauge theory. And the coupling of that gauge theory should be governed by the size of that circle. And then I should have something interesting happening at these pant diagrams. And Giotto's proposal was that the pant diagram corresponds to what's called a trifundamental field in the theory. So the essence of his proposal was that you were going to get from this construction in appropriate places in the moduli space a whole bunch of SU2s. One SU2 with a gauge coupling governed by the size. I should point out that these are supersymmetric gauge theories in four dimensions. They have N equal 2 supersymmetry in four dimensions. And as such, the gauge coupling naturally comes with another parameter. It's a circle-valued parameter called the theta angle. And fortunately, the mathematical theory of this stuff, So what I'm doing right now is putting what are called Fenchel-Nielsen coordinates on the Riemann surface. The mathematical theory says there are two coordinates that are important here. One is the length of the minimal length of the circle here, so the geodesic length in the hyperbolic metric, and the other is a twist parameter. So I get to specify my Riemann surface by specifying how long all those circles are together with how much twisting around the circle I did, and that twist parameter is naturally circle valued. So the combination of those two parameters, the length plus the twist, gives me a complex parameter. And there are 3g minus 3 in the absence of punctures, 3g minus 3 SU2s if no punctures.
So, do I surmise correctly that the metric of the surface is not important, only its conformal structure?
The metric of the surface is in principle important. The metric of this, this, as I said, we started with a gravity theory, so it's really this really is a metric description. But a lot of the properties are only care about the conformal structure.
Well, because you see what I'm confused about is the 3g minus 3 coordinates. Well, actually, it's 6g minus 6, I guess.
Yes, I'm sorry. It's 6g minus 6.
But that's the dimension of Titan.
Well, it's 3g minus 3 complex.
Yeah, that's right. So that's the Titan-Euler space description, which refers to the conformal geometry. But all this cutting into tubes and plumbing fixtures seems to be speaking about the actual metric. Because if you were only talking about conformal geometry, you wouldn't bother to cut it up in that way. You just cut it up into pairs of pants, right?
I could just cut it up into pairs of pants, but I guess the point that I'm making is that this picture of the tube being long when the circumference is small is an important feature of why I believe that there should be an SU2 associated with that in this setup.
I see, but the Lagrangian has nothing to do with the metric itself, just the conformal structure. It's conformally invariant.
So the Lagrangian is going to have in it a bunch of SU2s. It's going to have parameters for each one, which is the complexified gauge parameter. And that parameter I'm going to identify with at least a first-order approximation with the Fenchel-Nielsen coordinate on the Teichmuller space. And, of course, I had to choose a Pant decomposition for that to make sense. And then I'm only getting a weakly coupled description of the field theory in the corner of Teichmuller space where all of these circumferences are small.
But do you know whether is the point that the theory to begin with involves the metric on the surface and then you figure out that it's only the conformal structure later, or the input is that it's only the conformal structure on the surface that controls the physics?
So here's what makes it tricky to answer that question. What I'm giving from this M-theory construction is a gravitational way of constructing a four-dimensional theory. But I'm giving a so-called ultraviolet presentation of that theory, and what I'm trying to read off is infrared properties. And so, although I require a choice of metric to get the ultraviolet specification, the infrared properties are not going to depend on all of the details of the metric.
Can you say a little more about how you preserve supersymmetry here?
Yes, there's a magic... Maldacena Nunez, that's the magic phrase. So there's a solution, a beautiful solution of M-theory, which shows that compactifying on something like... So the solution actually uses the description of this punctured this Riemann surface or even a punctured Riemann surface as the Poincaré disk mod a discrete group. So the solution is actually for... Minkowski space cross, not just Min. Let's see.
Well, I'm forgetting something dumb, I think. But if you take a Riemann surface and look at, factorize it, the circle in the on the neck is a Schwarz circle under normal circumstances because it's contractible.
Right.
And that by itself would break the supersymmetry.
That's right. So it's important. So it's important that I'm using a hyperbolic metric here. So the Maldacena Nunez solution really uses a hyperbolic metric. That's why, and I don't actually, I don't have a solution that doesn't break supersymmetry if I don't have a hyperbolic metric, but I think I could probably still get away with it. The details of the hyperbolic metric are less important. And the point is that this is an approximate picture, this picture of the long tube, you know, it's approximately cylindrical along there, and so it seems like, you know, a good enough approximation that I could think of the SU2 as being, as coming from the same dimensional reduction Schirk-Schwarz type circle that I would have gotten over there.
Well, but Schirk-Schwarz would break the supersymmetry, that's why I'm asking it as anti-periodic boundary conditions for fermions.
I'm sorry, maybe I didn't mean Schirk-Schwarz, I guess I meant the Witten circle, if we can use that terminology, right? The M to 2A circle.
Yeah, right. I'm just trying to get
The real answer to how the supersymmetry survives is the Maldacena-Nunez solution, which explicitly keeps all the supersymmetry.
The sigma is wrapped on something, right? This tangent space is the right thing to
the tangents. There's something about the tangent space.
They're embedded as an large
right.
Tangent is also curved.
That's right.
To get this to work.
That's right.
So in other words, the full space is a Calabi-Yau or something.
A Calabi-Yau, which is simply the some rank 2 bundle over sigma or something like that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And the spin structure is a determined to be one that, I guess, is it the fully periodic spin structure?
Certainly true. I need to say what that is. Again, it comes from a choice of spin structure on the Poincaré disk, and so I just have to trace down for that choice of spin structure on my Poincaré disk mod gamma, what did I get on the Riemann surface?
So sigma can't be a force
for any of this? There certainly should be versions of this story where sigma is a torus, but we're actually going to assume that, you know, it's got a hyperbolic metric. So a once punctured torus or a 4 times punctured sphere would be fine if you're puncturing things. That's the way we'll get tori and sphere into the story, spheres into the story. So now I mentioned Wilson lines, which I had gotten ahead of myself. So an interesting ingredient in this four-dimensional theory, so I have some four-dimensional theory, and an interesting ingredient are these so-called Wilson line operators. Well, Wilson or Tuft line operators. We have line operators in general. And so a Wilson or a Tuft line operator consists of introducing some kind of one spatial dimension defect into the three spatial dimension theory. These can be possibly thought of as cosmic strings charged under some gauge group or something of that sort. And evaluating the path integral of the theory in the presence of this particular kind of defect. So there are two kinds. There are electrically charged ones. Those are traditionally called Wilson line operators. There are magnetically charged ones that are traditionally called Tuft operators. So I can take P, which is I can take a Q, which is some electric charge for the Wilson operators. I can take P, which is some magnetic charge for the other kinds of operators. And I can ask myself, how do I represent such objects for various values of P and Q in this more complicated theory? So I mentioned that this description of the theory only works in one corner of the moduli space. The moduli space, pleasantly, of this class of gauge theories with these trifundamental interactions matches to first approximation what we think of as the moduli space or the Teichmuller space, its universal cover, of the Riemann surfaces themselves. But of course, to match the global structure, I would have to be able to understand what happened in other corners of the moduli space where these geodesics were large. And the sort of big picture of the moduli space is that there, it has lots of different corners that don't cover everything, but anyway, there are lots of different corners where the separating geodesics in various pants decompositions in the Riemann surface become small. So I have different choices of these Fenchel-Nielsen coordinates. So this is Fenchel-Nielsen for pair of pant decomposition number one. So for example, I might do something like this. I might have a four punctured sphere, which I separated here. Or I might have a four punctured sphere, which I separated here, and then I would have the Fenchel-Nielsen coordinates for this pant decomposition. So if this is a valid description of the physical theory, I should be able to track various features of the physical theory as functions of parameters, and I should be able to compare what happened over in this region to what happened over in that region, which corresponds to different choices of pant decomposition, giving me different Fenchel-Nielsen coordinates. In both cases, here I've got a single loop, so I'm imagining being in a limit where this really becomes quite long here, right? That's the sort of metric picture, and here it would be long in the other direction. And I could try to compare various kinds of physical quantities, such as these Wilson loop operators, in one picture compared with another picture. So this is something that I worked out with Drucker and Okuda 2 years ago, and I'm sort of reviewing it again here because it's a simple way to see that interesting topological related features of the manifold theory are related to interesting features of the physical theory. And this kind of dictionary, which again is motivated by this idea of the construction from higher dimension, is what's at work with the three-dimensional theories that I'm going to be describing a little bit later. So how does it go here? I want to describe things with a certain electric charge and magnetic charge. And the basic picture is this tube, and the charge somehow corresponds to, let's see. So another part of the picture coming from the physics is that the origin of the gauge field, the one form in the physical theory, was by taking the original self-dual tensor field and reducing on the circle. So the gauge field should naturally be associated to the circle. And if I want to count, if I want something which reproduces electric charge, I should imagine taking a bunch of parallel copies of the gauge field to reproduce something that's generating electric charge. Whereas if I wanted something that had magnetic charge, I should be looking for things which cross the gauge field. So maybe if I'm looking for how many times does it cross the line defining this particular SU2, and how many times does it go parallel to this particular SU2. And my picture for these Wilson lines, again, coming from higher dimensions, was to represent them in terms of some curve sitting inside the surface. And when you look at it a little bit more, it turns out to be natural to assume that this curve has no self-intersections. So the kind of hypothesis is gamma is non-self-intersecting. And the data that I'm specifying is the number of crossings and the number of windings near each separating geodesic.
Let me just ask this, these words electric and magnetic, they're metaphors and they can be based on different things.
Here I have a gauge theory with an actual charge, and the electric objects are the things which are literally charged under that gauge field, and the magnetic objects in this theory are things which are charged under some dual object.
So does this translate into divergence versus curl? Electric is sort of a divergence and magnetic is a curl, or can I relate it to time?
like in ordinary electromagnetism, or curvature involving the time direction is electric?
Okay. So I can see I didn't get away with the simple answer. The more complicated answer is that I'm integrating the gauge field. I'm integrating the gauge field
along
the thing. That's correct. And in the case of the TUF operator, I've actually created a defect in the theory, and I have to do the integrals around.
And so one of those is electric.
That's correct. So it's along versus around, which is why, okay, thanks. I don't know if I'll get to that picture, but it's a nice picture, so. So it turns out that there's a mathematical result which is known some places as Dane's theorem and other places as the Dane-Thurston theorem. It has a kind of funny history. So it describes what are all the possible... Yeah, so I've drawn something wrapping around and something crossing as if it were intersecting, but of course that's not quite the right picture. What I really want to do is come in and then go around a bunch of times in a non-self-intersecting way. But then, of course, I might come in again and go parallel, right? My chances of drawing this are minimal. Anyway, we'll imagine that's parallel, and come out parallel. And I might do that a number of times. So the goal is to classify all the possible operators that would be like this, and then to compare, and the classification is going to depend on a Pant's decomposition, and then compare the classification I would get for different Pant's decompositions. I can make a computation in the physical theory which reflects the properties of these operators. I can analytically continue with respect to parameters and compare it with the computation in the physical theory for the other Pant's decomposition. So that's what Drucker, Okuda, and I carried out, and the key thing is this topological fact called the Dane-Thurston theorem, which classifies non-self-intersecting but not necessarily connected curves on a Riemann surface by these kinds of parameters, the number of crossings and number of windings near separating geodesics. So the history is kind of funny. So Dane proved this in the 1920s. It's in an unpublished manuscript of his, which finally did see the light of day when somebody... at Texas, published all of his unpublished work. Do you know the thing I'm talking about? I don't think it was Cameron Gordon. There's some nice book which is sort of all the unpublished writings of Dane, translated. Stillwell, that's who it was. And Thurston proved this and circulated a preprint, and in typical Thurston style also didn't publish that preprint. So there are these two unpublished proofs separated by 50 years, both of which eventually made it to print, because about 20 years later, Thurston did publish the preprint, and Dane's thing got published by Stillwell many, many years after he'd done the work. So the theorem characterizes in a Pant decomposition what happens, and so the first observation is that this was a closed curve. Did I say that? This is supposed to be a closed curve on the punctured Riemann surface. But it's, by the way, I'm going to allow, in some generalization, non-closed curves which have their boundary points on the punctures. So the same result goes through, but just for simplicity, let me not say that. If I take one pant at a time, and I want to draw it this way, so this is a better representation. It's something with three boundary circles. If I take one pant at a time, then and I've not oriented my curve, so the main thing I can say is that each segment... It's too bad I have no color chalk.
Isn't there a box sitting on the right side of the
trim? Not only a box. So if I take... any segment here, then it's got to meet the boundary twice. So the number of crossings has to be even. Right? So I called the number of crossings. I didn't really say which one was which, but the number of crossings you can see from that picture is the magnetic charge. Pi must be even. And then, you know, you can do various fun things with these pictures to get non-self-intersecting curves. So I could even go back along like this. There we go. So there's a typical kind of picture with an even number of boundaries and winding its way around the other guys in some fashion. Of course, I've just done it without any connections between boundaries. I'm certainly allowed to go from one thing to another thing. So this is a fairly typical picture of what that simple closed but not connected curve will look like when I restrict to one of these pants. So one of the things you need is a classification of these. Then you need to say what happens when you glue them together. And the key feature to notice when you glue them together is that, so this is going to bound some next pant. And what you can do is take any one of these guys and wind it around a certain number of times. I'll just do it once so I have a hope of drawing it, before coming out. And then once you've done that, all the parallel guys have to wind the same amount. So I get a winding number when I attach two of these together, which is independent of what the interior structure was. Okay, I'm done because I don't have any more room, but you can see that I could finish doing this without ever crossing anything if I had left myself enough room. So in gluing them together, you've got to include these windy things as well as the structure in the inside. The key data is, I've got Pi, Pj, and Pk, which are all non-negative, and which are the number of endpoints on each of these three bounding circles. And the little lemma is, if you've got such a thing, there exists a unique up to homotopy class of curves with that many boundaries. So it's not obvious from an example like this that such a statement would be true. Right here I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 on this guy, and 3 on this one, and 1 on this one, and somehow I managed to get such a guy. But there's a unique homotopy class, and you have to be careful about how you say it. So, you know, I could slide this guy around to be over on the other side, and that shouldn't count as essentially different. So you have to formulate it a little bit carefully, but if you formulate it carefully, this lemma is basically true. And then you put that together to arrive at the conclusion that the windings and crossing numbers at each of the separating geodesics uniquely characterize the class of the simple closed curve. And moreover, there's a simple set of conditions which essentially amount to the fact that all of these crossing numbers are even. It has to be modified at the punctures if you have punctures. But if there are no punctures, you can just say all the crossing numbers are even, which guarantees the existence of such an operator. So that's the theory of how you write down the possible curves, and then you can, you know, with a little bit of work, figure out in the context of the four-dimensional physical theory I'm discussing how to write down a partition function in the presence of those operators or something of that sort. You can then ask the question, so how do I change my Dane-Thurston parameters for the simple closed curve when I go from one pant decomposition to another? And that's the subject of Penner's PhD thesis, which gives a very explicit and unfortunately extremely long formula, so I won't try to write it down, which relates these Dane-Thurston coordinates for simple closed curves upon change of pant decomposition for the basic moves for pant decomposition. So this is one of them, but there are a couple of others, and for each of those basic moves, there's a dictionary which tells you how to change the P's and Q's on one side to the P's and Q's on the other side. The formula is really complicated, and so it's quite remarkable that to the extent we checked in a number of examples, it actually works out in the physical theory. So this is the kind of indirect thing I'm talking about, where one can find properties of the physical theories which are somehow related to each other. And those properties are the ones that would have been predicted by comparing different decompositions of the manifold and the basic way that we have of building up the 4D theory out of these building blocks, which in this case is just to put SU2s along loops and those trifundamental fields on pants, and use that as evidence that we are doing something right if we thought that this was all supposed to be coming from the mysterious six-dimensional theory.
So what was it that you checked more precisely?
So we looked at partition functions in the presence of a Wilson operator and compared gauge. So they should depend on the gauge parameters, and we analytically continued those gauge parameter expressions to the other region and compared with the computation for the other guy. Okay, so all this took a little longer than I expected, so I'm going to quite briefly introduce the newer work where we're going to go down to three-dimensional physical theories by using three manifolds. And the strategy for building up interesting three-dimensional theories is again going to be to chop the three manifolds into pieces in some form and then understand how those pieces fit together, both in terms of the mathematics and the physics, to reassemble the three manifolds that we're interested in. But it's not the direct analog of the pant decomposition, and there's not as direct a piece of evidence for the proposal for the basic physical theory that's being used. So this three-manifold story . So the most straightforward thing that you might try to do would have been to reduce to sort of try to write a three-manifold as being in some appropriate metric, having some Riemann surface cross interval structure, right? And then you would have kind of complicated other guys that would have Riemann surface boundaries and put out tubes again. And then you could use the tube idea. This time the tube itself would be more complicated. It would involve a Riemann surface rather than just a circle. Use those tube ideas to think you got gauge fields from those tubes, and then the interactions came from the three manifolds. And the problem is, well, there are lots of problems. One of the problems, as Daryl pointed out to me at lunch yesterday, is that I was arguing that I got weak coupling in the physical theory by virtue of being able to approach the boundary of the moduli space where those tubes became long and thin. I don't have that option here, particularly if I'm sticking with hyperbolic metrics. I'm not sure if I need to stick to hyperbolic metrics, but that's a good first approximation. And the problem is that the hyperbolic metrics on three manifolds are rigid. There aren't moduli to deal with. So I don't have this option of approaching some near some boundary of moduli space and getting some nice physical picture. Moreover, although that decomposition looks like a nice formal analog of a pant decomposition of a manifold, of a two-manifold, it's a really complicated thing to try to do this to three manifolds. So there have been various. I should mention that in the two-manifold case, there's a whole industry of really beautiful work in mathematical physics and string theory relating that picture of those four-dimensional theories to integrable systems, Liouville theories, so-called omega backgrounds. It's touched on a lot of things as it's been developed over the last couple of years. This analog for three manifolds is much newer. The most sort of coherent picture of how to use three manifolds to build three-dimensional gauge theories is in this paper of Gukov, Demofta, and Gyoto. Sorry, it's not alphabetical. Demofta, Gyoto, and Gukov from just about a month ago. So we heard, those of us who were at KITP this summer, heard lectures by both Gukov and Demofta related to this work. So it's been germinating for a while, and earlier papers of, for example, Gukov, Demofta, and Hollins last spring were important predecessors of this work. But the approach is not going to be to use that kind of decomposition of a three-manifold, but rather we want to decompose our three-manifold. Well, let's see. Before I say that, I should say, what class of three manifolds do I want? So I didn't fully explain what the role of the punctures was in the case of two manifolds, but I want to do a similar thing with three manifolds. So I want them to be punctured. And what that means in practice is that I want to look, if I stick with hyperbolic metrics for the moment, I want to look for hyperbolic metrics with cusp on some kind of collection of simple closed curves, but basically it should be a knot or more generally a link in my three manifold. So in the case of a Riemann surface, I took codimension two set, which was just a finite collection of points. That was where I put in these defects that has something to do with the physical theory. Here I'm going to take, again, a real codimension two set in my compact three manifold, but now the codimension two set can be some simple closed curve in the three manifold or a collection thereof. I mean, it doesn't have to be connected, and typically those things are knotted. So I should think of possibly some interesting knot or link in the three manifold. And I want some kind of metric on the complement of that guy. And so actually we're going to assume that it has definitely such things because we want to decompose the three-manifold into what are called ideal tetrahedra. So instead of doing a pant decomposition, I'm going to do a decomposition in which the basic object is a tetrahedron with a hyperbolic metric. That's a solid tetrahedron, right, to get a three-manifold with a hyperbolic metric. And it's a hyperbolic tetrahedron in the sense that it's got, can some three-manifold person help me say what it is better than I'm about to say? Probably.
It's a subset of hyperbolic tree space bounded by ideal triangles. These are subsets of hyperbolic plane.
So these edges are also supposed to be ideal.
Geodesics. The triangles are flat.
Right, and it's the vertices which are at infinity. Is that right?
The vertices are at infinity, and
So I have to put the vertices at infinity, and to have an infinity to be talking about, I had to put in this kind of cusp business to begin with, this puncture to begin with. So the picture is that I have some complicated three-manifold, and inside my three-manifold, I have some interesting knot or link, and you know. Since I'm not a three-manifold guy, I have no idea whether what I just drew was linked or not. No clue. Here, let's increase my chances. Still might not be linked. I don't know. Actually, now it might be knotted. It's connected.
It looks very unlinked.
Looks unlinked? Well, you know, you can always do this. Actually, doing that once, it's not often enough. So it might not be linked yet. I'll take some simple closed curve, which may or may not be knotted. May or may not be connected, right? I'm also going to allow boundaries of this thing. So in general, I might have wanted a compact one, but partly because I want to build things up out of more primitive pieces, and partly because of a physical interpretation of the objects that have boundaries that I'll describe in just a moment, I want to allow Riemann surface boundaries. Those Riemann surfaces might have punctures, and if the Riemann surface has a puncture, that should be extended into a boundary curve in the three-manifold that has its endpoints on the into a cusp curve on the three manifold, which has its endpoints on the boundary. So, you know, the metrically, these guys get pushed out to infinity, but near infinity, the simple closed curve gets sort of surrounded by a little torus, and that torus is asymptotically flat as I'm going out, whereas these boundary guys definitely get hyperbolic metrics on them, and you know, maybe these guys get pushed to infinity in those hyperbolic metrics, and that's compatible with this guy being a boundary. So that's the general kind of three-manifold we want to look at. We want to chop the thing up into these ideal tetrahedra glued along faces. So again, it's a solid tetrahedron. The edges and the faces should all be hyperbolically flat objects. If hyperbolically linear, how about that? It's probably better. And the boundary points are at the boundary of hyperbolic space. The boundary of hyperbolic space is a two-sphere with a natural conformal structure, which identifies it with the Riemann sphere. And four points on a Riemann sphere have a cross ratio, which is a complex number. So there's a cross ratio that's kind of the modulus of the building block ideal tetrahedron. And so what we have to learn about is how to associate a physical theory to that somehow depends on the cross ratio, how to glue them together along walls. First of all, why it's true that you can glue the ideal, you can decompose the three-manifold into ideal tetrahedra, and then how you would reassemble the physical theory by gluing along walls in some appropriate sense. When you're done, the physical theory ought to be powerful enough to produce some kinds of invariance for the three-manifold. So the paper that I mentioned, the Dimofta, Gyota, Kukov paper, has a specific proposal for a physical theory to associate to this basic building block, has a specific proposal for how to use the gluing